John Honoré, Carla Guthrie, John Nielsen Gammon, John Schrader, Phil Bedient, Nick Fain, David Maidment. So I got John, got Carla, John Gammon, John Schroeder or Schrader. That you? That's I know that guy. Phil Bedient. Phil Bedient coming. All right, there you go. All right, let's go ahead and start. John,
Good evening, everyone. My name is John
pull that
Otter.
real
Oh,
close
sorry.
and speak loud.
Good evening, everyone. My name is John Honoré. I'm a section chief with the Texas Division of Emergency Management, and I am the agency's chief meteorologist.
Ten
I've been an
twenty-eight
operational
forty.
meteorologist for 31 years, an overwhelming majority of that in various regions of Texas. And I've been with TDEM for a little over 8 years. I've been asked to speak on a couple of topics today, so I'll speak about those now. One of the things I was asked to talk about is how meteorological data is collected, analyzed, and used for disaster planning by TDEM and our partners. Most of that data is collected by the National Weather Service, as well as the Weather Service's parent agency, NOAA. That includes satellite data, radar data, weather balloon data, surface observations, and other types of remote sensing. That data is then taken and put into different computer models that are generated by not only NOAA, but private companies, foreign weather services, and other entities. I take those forecast models, and my team analyzes that scientifically, as well as analyzes it based off of our experience to help inform the agency's operational posture. As far as how that is used, I'd like to refer you to Chief Kidd's testimony last week and how he uses that information for his decision making. But the big picture is this: we didn't have any access to any exclusive information. My team is we're there to inform TDEM's operational decisions based on public information provided by the Weather Service, as well as that weather information that comes in from the Weather Service. Our team's extensive experience and understanding of Texas weather and the history of Texas weather is what leads us to make some of those operational recommendations to TDEM leadership on pre-deployment timelines to best support our locals ahead of potential storm impacts. While our field teams are often and regularly communicate these forward-leaning operations and work with our local partners to ensure proper coordination, we also provide updates on these tactical decisions on a 10 a.m. statewide weather call, which is hosted by TDEM, featuring a National Weather Service briefing, updates from the Texas Emergency Management Council members, and other partners. With regard to conditions leading up to the 4th of July, for several weeks this summer, we had a persistent onshore flow at all levels of the atmosphere from across the Atlantic Ocean, through the Caribbean, into the Gulf, and into Texas. It was pointed right at us. It made for, even by Texas standards, unusually humid conditions. So we had a moisture-rich environment. Then the weekend before, leading up, or actually 3 weeks before, pardon me, it's been mentioned before, we had a serious flash flood event in the San Antonio metro area. Parts of Medina, Bexar, Comal counties had areas of 5 to 9 inches of rain. We saw that, given a lot of the weather data, the potential for that type of flooding, there was no way to pinpoint exactly where that flooding would be. The atmosphere was very, very wishy-washy. It's very difficult for the computer modeling to get a handle on exactly where that heavy rain is going to set up. But the conditions were out there for something like that to happen. And sure enough, we had a serious flash flood event in San Antonio, and that put us on even more vigilant stance going into the upcoming weeks. So the weekend before the 4th of July, we had Tropical Storm Barry make its way onshore into Mexico, traveled through northern Mexico, kind of dissipated, but its remnants moved through West Texas and eventually started to work its way into Central Texas. At that point, some of the computer modeling started to pick up on the heavy rain threat. That in and of itself, just the fact that we've got a weak disturbance floating around slowly in a very humid environment is going to set off red flags. It's even been mentioned here on this panel. Also mentioned was Harvey, Imelda, Allison, all slow-moving storms. The difference with this, though, is that it wasn't a named, organized storm with a well-defined center that the computer models could really latch onto and understand where it was going to go and how much rain it was going to drop in specific locations. We didn't, this system was much more analogous to the flood of 2002, where you had just a very weak disturbance floating around the hill country, tapping into a very humid atmosphere and dumping a tremendous amount of rain. The problem is we've seen that before, after 2000, or excuse me, after 2002, didn't generate this type of rain. So going into the fourth, in the days coming into the fourth, there was computer modeling showing extremely heavy amounts of rain, but it was not consistent as to how much or where it was going to fall. But given our experience and our knowledge of Texas history, it gave us cause for concern to inform our leadership and our partners that there was concern that there was a serious flash flood risk going into the 4th of July weekend. So that's basically what the setup was going into that storm that occurred over the 4th of July weekend. And I just wanted to say we remained committed to working with our local partners and stakeholders to ensure communities have the resources they need before, during, and after a disaster. And I thank you for your time.
So I'm going to violate my rule because I can, our rule. Real quick, really what I wanted to hone in on, because there's a lot of confusion last week, and rightfully so, we're not weather people. As to who's got data, who uses data, what they use the data, and where does the data come from. So specifically, and I'm going to share from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, and I've got another six opportunities are here to correct me for sure. NOAA is the keeper of all inputs that generates the models that you take and every meteorologist around the country takes.
An overwhelming majority of it,
And so
yes.
NOAA is getting feeds from gauges, USGS gauges, we've talked to those ad nauseum, local sources, private sector sources, mesonets. Texas has large mesonet networks, both at TEC, Texas Water Development Board, and then private sector. And even I think I heard a different one today. LCRA may have their own. So
Correct.
all of that is pushing data up as inputs, no modeling, just they push that raw input. They put it in their system and they generate what they believe is a forecast, and that's what your 10 o'clock calls are based on. That's what your internal conversations are centered around. Is that basically the correct understanding?
Sir, I'm not fully up to speed on everything that the Weather Service puts together to come up with their forecast. So I wouldn't want to, it would be irresponsible for me to definitively say, yeah, that's what they do.
Sure. But in general, we have more data gatherers than we have more predictors. We leave the predictions up from kind of coming out of NOAA down to National Weather Service. And then the local guys kind of get to add their flavor to it, I guess. Is that kind of a general statement?
You're saying that when you say the local guys,
There's local input once it gets kind of out of.
so you're referring to the Weather Service
Right.
again. Again,
Okay.
I
That's
don't think
fine.
I'd be very responsible
Fair
for
enough.
me to comment
We'll
on
go
that.
to the next the panel. We'll try to get through them, members. I just wanted to set effectively what we needed to know is who's sending data, who's using the data, what it's for, And then we get into the whole modeling conversation in this panel too, which is kind of where all the magic happens. You know, all this stuff comes together and people put it together and come up with what they think is right. So let's move on down it. I just want to kind of set that stage because we're going to hear, if you're going to say the same thing that we just agreed to, you can skip that part of your 10 minutes. All right. Thank you.
Good evening, Chairman Perry, Chairman King, Vice Chairs and members of both the Senate and House Select Committees. My name is Carla Guthrie, Surface Water Division Director for the Texas Water Development Board. Thank you for the opportunity to describe our TexMesNet statewide weather network that we're working to build for Texas and to answer any questions that you may have. Although floods are a part of the Texas landscape, the events that occurred this past month are particularly tragic, and I offer my heartfelt condolences to everyone who is affected. Today, I will provide a general overview of the MESNET system operated by the Texas Water Development Board, a description of its utility for natural disaster-related planning and response, and recommendations for improving TexMESNET for this purpose. I will address each of these topics and welcome questions to fill in the gaps. You also have a presentation in front of you that will be helpful for understanding what I'll present. So next slide, please. The TexMESNET is a statewide hydrometeorological observation network that's operated by the Texas Water Development Board. It is designed to collect and distribute high quality, near real time atmospheric and soil moisture data across Texas. The network supports water resources management, drought and flood monitoring, emergency response, agriculture, scientific research, and more. Specific to natural disasters, the initial station in the stations in the network were installed to provide better data for warning and forecasting of flood events following the Memorial Day Wimberley flood. However, station data also is informative for droughts, heat waves, tornadoes, fire, wind, winter storms, and tropical systems and hurricanes. In 2023, the 88th Texas Legislature authorized the TWDB to serve as the statewide resource for hydrometeorological data as described in Texas Water Code 16.026. However, the first TexMESNET stations began reporting in 2016. And today we have 118 stations reporting across Texas, and we are continuing to build this network out to at least 225 TWDB owned stations to fill in gaps in coverage. The map on your slide shows TWDB owned stations in orange, and the gray triangles show all other locations where we have partner networks that have similar weather station information. The counties shaded in gray reflect those most impacted by the recent floods. Next slide, please. Each TexMESNET station collects a suite of parameters, including temperature, precipitation, and soil moisture. The data we provide is available for use as needed by others, both during disaster and in clear weather periods. In a few slides, I'll go over how we make the data publicly accessible. But I also wanted to show on this slide the MESNET coverage in Kerr and surrounding counties. There are two stations within Kerr County, a station at the Kerr Wildlife Management Area and another at the Kerrville Municipal Airport. However, there are other stations just outside of the county that also provide coverage. And so if you look at the slide, you can see a series of orange circles and gray circles. Those circles represent the coverage around a station. And so we are designing, we're building out the network so that there is at least a 20-mile buffer or between stations. So around each station, there's a 10-mile radius. So when you look at that, you can see that there's fairly good coverage for MESNET stations in Kerr County. This also is not showing the GBRA rain gauge stations, which also provide coverage. So while there are gaps, there is a reasonable amount of coverage, and I wanted to point that out to you today. Next slide, please. Much like the National MESNET Program, of which TexMESNET is a member, we have designed our program to operate as a network of networks. We rely heavily on partnerships as well as our own stations. Texas is large, and by working with existing MESNETs and state partners, we are better able to provide a cost-effective means for ensuring broad coverage. There are partnerships such as with West Texas MESNET, who covers West Texas and the Panhandle, and other entities as listed on the table on the right. We are able to display data from over 3,500 cooperator-owned stations on TexMESNET.org. With respect to the collaborative nature of our program, we rely on the TxMesNet Advisory Committee to guide our program on data collection and dissemination methods and on product development. We have two of our committee members here on the panel today. Dr. John Nielsen-Gammon serves as our chair, and Dr. John Schrader is representing West Texas TxMesNet. We also have representatives from the National Weather Service, Regional Weather Networks, Oklahoma TxMesNet program, state agencies, and members with expertise in a variety of subjects. TxMesNet also contracts with several universities to improve data products, data quality, station coverage, education, and outreach. However, one important point that I want to make today is that TxMesNet relies on landowners to provide space to host stations. We have agreements with Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, other state and local entities, as well as with private landowners. And this is one of our greatest limitations to expanding the number of stations in areas that lack coverage. We need to find landowner hosts who are willing to provide the space and access for a station, and we welcome those who have the space and are willing to partner with us to help us continue to expand the network. Next slide, please. TWDB stations collect and report out all measurements every 5 minutes. However, many stations in our partner network collect and report at different frequencies. There's not a standard across all networks, and remember that each network is designed for a different purpose. And not all need to report at a 5 minute rate all of the time for all parameters. The pie chart that is shown on the left slide shows the proportion of stations in Texas that are collecting data at various frequencies. From our assessment, a majority of stations, the color shown in blue, so 39%, collect data between 5 and 15 minutes, but only 23% of stations are collecting data at a frequency of 5 minutes or less. And so in terms of the frequency of reporting data, most networks are not reporting at a fast rate. The American Association of State Climatologists recommends a 5 minute collection and reporting rate. And this is the rate at which our stations adhere to. And there are only two networks in Texas, TxMesNet and West Texas TxMesNet, that meet this 5 minute data collection and reporting requirement for stations. And these locations are shown on the map that's on your right. And so you can see much of the state lacks stations that are reporting at a high enough frequency to be informative during intense rain events. Next slide, please. On this slide, we wanted to show why it's important to have 5 minute rain data. You can see here a graph for rain gauge data at the Kerr Wildlife Management Area. It's within the watershed of the North Fork of the Guadalupe River. In this graph, the orange line represents data at 5 minute intervals, and the gray line represents 1 hour reporting interval. If I can draw your attention to the yellow highlighted area between 3 a.m. and 4 a.m., we can see how receiving information in 5 minute intervals allows for quicker decision making. And I want to note here that at 3 a.m., we already had 2 inches of rainfall in the watershed, and we were about to receive 3 more inches. So having a 5 minute data reporting rate is extremely important for monitoring intense rain events such as this, where rain fell at a rate of 1/2 inch every 10 minutes for that period of time. And so we would encourage a 5 minute rate of reporting for all partner networks if the National Weather Service and emergency responders agree that it would be meaningfully helpful during such events. Next slide, please. I want to close by describing the two ways in which we access our data is accessible. First, TWDB station data is delivered from our stations to our cloud server via AT&T's FirstNet communication platform. And then it goes to our online web viewer at TxMesNet.org. The viewer is the most common way to interact with the data. It contains TWDB station data, which is pulled from our cloud server. It also contains active radar precipitation visuals and data from over 3,500 stations within and surrounding Texas. For the viewer, we also pull data from non-TWDB stations. So we pull that from Synoptic and from West Texas TxMesNet. The main landing page is available in Spanish and English, and additional pages provide precipitation and temperature maps and allow for limited data downloads. During the July 2025 flood event, TxMesNet stations were reporting near real-time data, and the viewer remained operational throughout the event. Users of the viewer include the National Weather Service Hydrologic Service Coordinators who've used this viewer at the State Operations Center and as part of their briefing notices. Other users include educators, news meteorologists, general public, emergency responders, farmers, and more. Next slide, please. The second way to access our data is through Synoptic, who pulls our data from our servers into their database. Once the data goes to Synoptic, it is available to be downloaded for use by anyone for whatever purpose they need. Synoptic houses TWDB data, partner data, and data from other public and private entities. And within Synoptic, the National Weather Service is able to use the Meteorological Assimilation Data Ingest System, MADIS, to access this data. And so to recap, we have two ways in which this data is available for events such as this. Our data viewer, which is helpful during an actual event to see the event as it unfolds, and then via Synoptic, where raw data can be downloaded for scientific analysis or used in modeling. And so this concludes a high-level overview of the TexMesNet program at the Texas Water Development Board. I thank you to the committees for your interest and attention in our program. We are also appreciative of the support this program has and continues to receive from the legislature. We believe TexMesNet offers great value to Texans, and we welcome all suggestions
thank that you very much.
Make this program more beneficial.
Thank you very much for that. We'll be back to you shortly. Please proceed. Just state your name and tell us what you're here for.
Thank you. My name is John Nielsen-Gammon, College Station, Texas. I'm the Texas State Climatologist, Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at Texas A&M University, and the Director of the Southern Regional Climate Center. Chairman Perry, Chairman King, and committee members, let me say at the outset, I hold deep sorrow for the victims of the Hill Country floods this month, their families and friends, and everyone else who's been touched by this disaster. In the interest of time, I'm going to hit key points of my written testimony here. I was appointed the Texas State Climatologist by Governor Rick Perry in the year 2000. The mission of the office is to help the state of Texas make the best possible use of weather and climate information. The Office of the State Climatologist, or OSC, has no statutory responsibilities for disaster planning and response. Indeed, there is no enabling legislation for the OSC. The office was created at Texas A&M by Governor Briscoe in 1973 in response to a pullback from NOAA, from state-level climate services. We received no direct baseline funding through the state budget. Our operating budget is provided by Texas A&M University. We also receive occasional funding from state agencies for particular projects. Given my own scientific background and experiences, I've made the focus of the office extreme weather in Texas, particularly droughts and floods. Much of this research and service is directed toward understanding extreme rainfall risks, which in turn can inform planning and preparedness activities. In my testimony, I highlight a few examples, and I provide a more detailed list as an addendum to this testimony. In 2005, we analyzed every rainfall event in Texas from 1948 to 2002 that produced at least 20 inches of rain. There were quite a few such events. We also looked at computer simulations with rainfall in one particular event that happened to be the July 2002 event that John Honore just mentioned. We found that for events like this, it was not possible to predict the locations of extreme rainfall at the county level a day or two in advance with computer models, no matter how good the data is. I also worked directly with state and local agencies when requested, such as TM, ERCOT, PUC, the Railroad Commission, and TCEQ, and TWDB. For Harris County Flood Control District, we looked specifically at the new numbers from NOAA Atlas 14, which is the document that lays out how much rainfall you expect in a 100-year event, and considered whether those numbers were too high for Southeast Texas because of Hurricane Harvey skewing the statistics, or alternatively, whether they were too low because of climate change. We concluded it was some of both. The 100-year amounts are probably overestimates for the present-day climate, but in three or four decades, the climate will catch up. We later broadened our study to look at all the South and Southeast United States and found that overall the amount of rainfall with a 1% chance in any given year has increased by about 15% over the past several decades. What particularly concerns me are the implications for all the places outside of Southeast Texas, like Kerr County, that didn't get a Harvey bump in their statistics. For them, the official 1% annual rainfall numbers and floodplain extents are likely already too small because they assume there's been no trend in extreme rainfall. There are things going on right now that try to fix the problem. NOAA has work in progress, for example, due to their own study mandated by Congress. But the TWB has contracted with me to develop new extreme rainfall return values for Texas that take historic trends into account. I brought in colleagues from A&M and from Rice University to help on the project. We're testing out some strategies we think will produce more reliable numbers than what NOAA will be coming up with. We're in the final stages of that study now, and we expect the results to be available sometime in the fall. Now I wish to talk specifically about the Hill Country floods and some recommendations regarding them. This being Texas, there are plenty of past floods in this very river basin that in different parts of the basin rivaled or exceeded what happened on July 4th at or upstream of Comfort. July 1869, September 1915, July 1932, August 1978, and July 1987. More broadly, various historic precipitation totals in the Hill Country are sobering, keeping in mind that the Guadalupe River flood was caused by 10 to 15 inches of rain, and the floods near Mason County and Leander were produced by about 20 inches. September 1921, east of Austin, 36 inches of rain in 18 hours, a United States record at the time. July 1932, Mountain Home, about 20 miles upstream, 19.6 inches in 6 hours, over 33 inches in 24 hours. May 1935, north of DeHaenas, 21.8 inches in less than 3 hours. June 1948, Sycamore Creek, 36 inches total. June 1954, Pandale, 35 inch total. August 1978, between Hunt and Medina, over 48 inch total rainfall over 2+ days. Based on a simple count of these events, we should expect a 35-inch rainstorm, which would be well over a 1,000-year event, somewhere in the area, on average, every 2 decades. Now, that doesn't seem possible if it's a 1,000-year event, but keep in mind, it's a 1,000-year event at any given particular location, and every individual location has its own odds. Regarding weather warnings, getting warnings is one thing from the Weather Service. Determining the proper action is another. Sometime in the middle of the night, the situation changed from there's a flash flood, appropriate action is to stay indoors and not drive, to there's a flash flood, appropriate action is to seek higher ground if you're less than 20 feet above the river, or then less than 25 feet, or less than 30, or possibly less than 50, as the situation evolved. And the weather warnings did not keep pace with that threat and with the change in action necessary. But during the past 23 years, there's been 111 flash flood or flow warnings issued by the National Weather Service specifically for Hunt, Texas. It's critical that any future warning system clearly identify the appropriate action to take, and that action needs to have a reasonable probability of actually being necessary under the circumstances, or people will again start ignoring the warnings. And furthermore, that action should be supplemented by education on which places are at risk and what to do, how to evacuate at any given location. Regarding better data and models, I'll focus on models of the atmosphere that predict precipitation. The Weather Service runs several models of short range to long range. The shorter range models have higher resolution, can actually resolve thunderstorms. Most private companies don't run their own models. They take the NWS models and forecasts and apply them specifically to customer needs. With the threat of extreme rainfall a day or two in advance, or even understanding the rainfall potential during the event, it's remarkable to me how poor the National Weather Service models were at providing a 24 or 48 hour warning of this event. Probably other models didn't do much better. Part of the problem is that in Texas, the air that makes extreme rainfall enters the state from over the Gulf or northern Mexico, where observations are scarce or of lower quality. I've heard the key tip-off of heavy rain potential was the Thursday morning weather balloon launch from Del Rio. Why Del Rio in particular? Believe it or not, Del Rio is the only upper air station along the Texas border between El Paso and Brownsville, a distance of over 700 miles. It's worth considering whether additional observations along our border, what's coming into the state above ground level, would improve short-term forecasts of extreme rainfall and severe thunderstorms and tornadoes. I believe that they would. It's possible to do experiments with computer models to test the impact of different observing systems on the forecast and then put in the systems that make the most sense. Among the technological options are profilers from the ground that measure moisture, temperature, and wind aloft, and having additional information from three or four sites may well have narrowed the area of flood risk considerably. Looking even more broadly, the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, my department, has been developing an idea to host a Texas Hazard Weather Interagency Coordination Center, which would help coordinate meteorologists in various agencies, including TDEM, GWB, and other agencies on a longer timescale than the primary concern of TDEM, which would be looking from 2 to 14 days and up to seasonal outlooks. We would look closely with TDEM, and TDEM would take over once emergencies was impending. So thank you for attention. I'll be looking forward to answering your questions.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is John Schrader. I'm a professor of atmospheric science at Texas Tech University, also the senior director of the National Wind Institute. My career has almost exclusively been focused on making measurements from the atmosphere using radars, LIDARs, tower-based measurements, and other devices. I'll be offering insights today on our West Texas Mesonet, as well as some forecasting insights and making some recommendations on how we might improve our monitoring systems for this particular type of event. Next slide, please. A good project within my institute that has a first order impact on situational awareness of weather is the West Texas Mesonet. It's a network of 168 high quality weather stations that are distributed over the western part of the state. It was initiated over 25 years ago and has slowly grown over the years outward from Lubbock and just about every direction. It's truly been woven into the fabric of West Texas. Our team handles almost every aspect of the related workflow. We deploy and maintain the stations. We create, manage the IT systems. We generate custom products. We disseminate the data. We integrate outputs onto our website, cell phone application, and data feeds. Next slide, please. The user community is really diverse. Agriculture, energy, transportation. But we have maintained a strong focus on weather. And one of our major partners is the National Weather Service. Our measurements directly feed into NOAA via the National Mesonet Program, but they also directly feed into the regional offices of the National Weather Service through our partnership in the local Weather Service office in Lubbock. Our measurements end up in the AWIP system, which is the National Weather Service's own system in their office. As mentioned previously, we've also send data to other partners, such as the Texas Water Development Board, and take part in their network approach that was promoted earlier. Now, thinking about forecasting for an event, forecasting in the 1 to 2 day ahead of time perspective really is handled by using two different types of information. One is the measurements themselves that gives you situational awareness of what's going on in the atmosphere and the atmospheric conditions. The other is using the numerical models that will assist you in making future predictions of what maybe the atmosphere might do in a few days. The same measurements that provide you situational awareness also are inputted into the model as it help provide the initial state for that model that gets marched forward in time. As an event gets closer to happening, or maybe is starting to happen, the measurements become exceedingly critical. In most cases, the warnings or the emergency communications that go out are going to be based on real-time understanding of the measurements, what's happening on the ground, what's the facts that are coming back that are available to the forecaster. Now, you might think that once we get to that point, that modeling really doesn't play a role, but that's not really the case. Even in that case, the storm is already formed. Some of the best tools that have been produced by NOAA in the recent years is the Warn On Forecast System. That system may actually produce better information once the storm is already produced. It has an advanced assimilation technique where it takes even things like radar data and ports it into the model. And then there's a high resolution ensemble-based system that actually produces probabilistic output based on things like, what's that storm going to do in the next 6 hours? Is it going to die? Is it going to stall somewhere? Is it going to move off to the east, to the north? These sorts of things can yield probabilistic output that has real value, sort of like, hey, there's a 50% chance that the western part of this county is going to get 7 inches of rain in the next 6 hours. That's very actionable intel for a forecaster. It's exceedingly valuable. So even at that late time frame, numerical models can provide input. So in looking towards making recommendations, a sort of a comprehensive recommendation is probably what we would lean on. Let's go to slide five. Thank you. So one of the things we've heard over and over again today is this idea of adding stations, adding ground truth, okay? Filling gaps in existing networks, whether that be rain gauge gaps or high quality Mesonet stations. The map that's shown there is from the region and includes the West Texas Mesonet stations and the high quality Texas Water Development Board stations. And there are still gaps, even in the Hill Country, that could be filled. And we've heard numerous times today the idea of filling rain gauge gaps and maybe strategically placing rain gauges in certain places upstream where creeks and streams are especially vulnerable. Next slide. But we would also recommend that you consider adding additional technology. Radar can be added to help map the wind, the rainfall. In particular, adding high resolution radar at locations closer to the headwaters region and using low-level scanning techniques can really enhance our ability to pinpoint rainfall and occurrence, not only the location and intensity. Radar provides a spatially continuous coverage. That's advantageous. And when you merge high-resolution radar data with the ground-based truth underneath of it, with the rain gauges and the high-resolution weather stations, that provides the most effective way to monitor rainfall. It's actually the best tool we have in our toolkit. Next slide. The other recommendation we would make is that Texas consider setting up its own Texas Prediction Center. This would not be something that would replace NOAA. Rather, it would just complement NOAA's own national forecast models. In this particular case, we believe that it would focus on the 0 to 48-hour period. It should use high-resolution systems that can better model thunderstorms and more accurately produce rainfall intensities. At the same time, we believe it should use an ensemble approach so it can capture uncertainty, highlight extremes, and provide probabilistic forecasts. You remember before, one of the things I said was this nice tool that NOAA has called the Worn-On Forecast System. NOAA decides each day where to apply that system. It's applied on a subgrid across the country. And if there are, they usually try to find places where there's going to be high impact weather to apply it. Well, if there happens to be a tornado outbreak focused for Iowa and a flooding event focused for Texas, there's a pretty decent chance that we would lose that pipe. And I think one of the things that we should do is set up a Texas system and bring that worn on forecast system architecture over to that system so that we're never left out. We always have our forecasters have access to that level of information because it is really valuable from their perspective. So I've been talking a lot about forecasting and these systems and what they could provide. Obviously, the output can impact much more than just a forecaster. That output can impact weather warning systems. That output can impact how agencies prepare to respond to an event. That output can be handed downstream to someone who's going to model the hydrology. If we can provide a probabilistic output of the weather output and hand it to a hydrologist, they can provide probabilistic output for the stream. And so we can build upon these ideas downstream and build a better system. The fundamental idea here is we want to arm our forecasts and our decision makers with the best possible information we can, with the best possible tools to do their job. And we believe following through on recommendations like this would take a giant step forward to do that. Thank you.
Next.
Yes, thank you. First of all, I greatly appreciate the invite from the chairs and the committee members here. I'm Phil Bedient at Rice University. I run the SPEED Center, Severe Storm Prediction, Education, Evacuation from Disaster Center. It's been in place all the way back to about for about the past 15 years. In the aftermath of this devastating storm in 2025, it's clear that the need for reliable real-time flood warning systems has never been more urgent. The meteorologists up and down the table here that have just presented have set me up very nicely because, again, at the end of the day, the rain hits the ground and that's where the issue is with the runoff and the floods that ensue. So it's never been more urgent. While rural and urban areas experience flooding in different ways, both face life-threatening risks without timely information. For decades at Rice, SPEED has led efforts in flood modeling and disaster preparedness. The state-of-the-art model, Flood Information and Response System called FIRST, provides accurate real-time forecasts to protect and critical infrastructure and communities in the Houston area in four major watersheds within the downtown Houston area and outer reaches as well. The system's capabilities are applicable to both urban centers and rural regions nationwide where flash floods occur. Floods happen fast, and as extreme weather events are becoming more common due to all sorts of changes, we're seeing these happen more frequently, especially in the last 15, 20 years. In Houston alone, we've just been hammered over there, but nothing as devastating as what hit here in the Hill Country. The designer of this system and the way in which we pulled this together, my colleague here, Dr. Nick Fang at UT Arlington, will speak next. We helped put this together to create early possible warnings and ideally hours before flash flooding occurs. So it's a unique approach, and it actually started more than 25 years ago with work on the Texas Medical Center post-tropical storm Allison. So it was initially developed there. It serves as a critical decision support tool for emergency management. It provides data every 10 to 15 minutes over a variety of the watersheds, and it instantly displays flood risk in a very easy to use visual map. Now, by that I mean we get rainfall on the ground in visual maps, and those are provided in some of the handouts that I've given to you. But in addition, we also get to see in the background we have built out about 100 floodplain maps, and these maps are driven by amounts of rain that vary from 5 to about 18 inches in the upstream and the downstream portion of these watersheds. And that combination of rainfalls then provides 100 floodplain maps. As the radar falls each 15 minutes, those floodplain maps are selected and shown, and basically you're seeing that rain passing through the watershed, and so it has a timing sequence associated with it. So FIRST was created to serve essential facilities, critical facilities, hospitals, nursing homes, fire stations, communities. It could be camps. It could be whatever that are vulnerable to flooding. During major storm events, every minute counts. Our system helps city and county officials and emergency responders in Houston determine where and when to issue warnings, close roads, or evacuate neighborhoods. If any region records in Houston for over about 5 inches of rain, the system pulls from an extensive floodplain map library, which was invented by Dr. Fang back for his PhD work years ago, to simulate and display expected inundation zones. And this system has been built and tested for a number of years, and it's worked extremely well for us. These maps allow precision flood forecasts based on both upstream and downstream rainfall levels. We're not just looking at rainfall, we're looking at how the rain moves through the watershed. And of course, we're using very accurate radar-based rainfall that's been adjusted by actual rain gauges. And this occurs every 10 to 15 minutes throughout the watershed. It interacts with infrastructure and how it puts people at risk. And that's what makes FIRST so powerful. It combines real-time radar with detailed flood modeling to tell us what's happening and what's likely to happen next. The July 2025 Hill Country flood is a sobering reminder of what's at stake. We took a careful look at the radar data for that, and Dr. Fang will report on that. We got about 10 inches of rain across the upper Guadalupe River Basin within just a few hours. The landscape, known for its steep hills and of course, rocky terrain, transformed into a powerful raging torrent. with river surging over 30 feet. This is one of the worst floods we've ever seen in this area. And it moved at staggering velocities with a staggering and devastating loss of life. It's heartbreaking to see that. Events like this reinforce why real-time flood warning systems based upon radar and advanced technology are not just in big cities and rural areas, but they need to be provided. The tools exist. We just need to put them into place. I've also got some handouts that I've provided to you that clearly show some of these maps and what they look like through time. And with that, I will close and I'll defer to my colleague, Dr. Fang.
Go ahead, Dr. Fang.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Phil. And thank you, Chairman Perry and Chairman King and all the committee members. And be very honored to share my knowledge here today. I think all the scientists, research professors here, I mean, already shared many good, I mean, stuff here.
Dr. Fang, if you'll pull that real close and talk real big.
Trying to eat it. So what I'm trying to say here is a couple points. I mean, is that any flood warning system is not about the system itself. It needs a couple things. One is the infrastructure, which is all the model and the system itself, computer infrastructure. And second one here is human being, because you cannot really solely depend on, I mean, the system itself and to make a decision, I mean, there too. So that really leaves in a couple, really the questions right here is the system not only need upfront funding, but also we need to have a recurring funding to support a system and even the putting the operation maintenance costs there as well. And plus additional funding for future research and development there. So those are the things I think over the years, I really realized to have a successful system is not only about building system itself. Obviously we're researchers and we also educators as well. So many different things when we're doing it, we wanted to provide a very solid public education. Flood science is a very complex topic these days. And Texas is big and we have very sophisticated terrain in Texas and different climatic zones. And so we cannot really develop one single flood warning system for whole Texas these days. We have to tailor the system itself for different zones because terrain is very different. Climate is very different. So universities here, we are actually helping, I mean, the state agencies. And we like to kind of work with the state agency, provide what we learn, not only the past knowledge, but also the new knowledge in AI and machine learning. We've been very fortunate to working with the Water Development Board over the years and to assist them to develop the flood warning system guideline and also the rainfall enhancement there as well. So really the point right here, I want to urge the state really consider about the flood warning system is not one-time investment. It's a recurring investment and continues. And second one here is a flood is very infrequent natural phenomenon. I mean, it's very easy to lose people's focus if the weather getting dry. And we still need to continue invest this area as well. So I'm just going to, for the interest of time, stop right here.
Chairman Perry, Chairman King, members of the committees. I'm David Maidman, Professor Emeritus of Civil Engineering, representing the Center for Water and the Environment of the University of Texas at Austin. Like my fellow Texans, I have been shocked and devastated by the awful flood disaster that occurred on the Guadalupe River and elsewhere on Independence Day. The loss of 137 lives, many of them children, marks a heartbreaking chapter in our state's history. For me, this is especially poignant because for the past 10 years, I have been at the Center for Water and Environment. Our team is working with the state agencies, the National Weather Service, and the U.S. Geological Survey to enhance real-time flood information. We focus on assessing what happens to the water once it hits the ground, flows through the rivers and streams, and creates flood impacts. We do not work on weather or precipitation forecasting. During these years, we have worked closely with Chief Kidd and TDAM. I served in the State Operations Center throughout Hurricane Harvey, helping to provide improved flood information. Since 2017, our research has been sponsored by TxDOT. This is the largest single research project in the history of that agency. We wish to thank the TxDOT Research and Technology Implementation Program for their strong and sustained support of our research effort. Over the past 10 years, steady progress has been made in the following areas. National Water Model. In 2015, the National Weather Service established a new National Water Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, to improve national flood forecasting. We led the engagement of the academic community with the National Weather Service to create the National Water Model. A prototype of this model was developed in Austin at the Texas Advanced Computing Center, or TAC, in 2015. And the model was made operational by the National Weather Service in 2016. The National Water Model continually forecasts flow throughout the stream network of the United States, including 200,000 miles of streams and rivers in Texas. Water has become like weather, forecast everywhere, all the time. Statewide flood inundation mapping. With the support of TDEM, we created in 2016 the first version of large-scale, real-time flood inundation mapping. This methodology was adopted by the National Weather Service and is now being deployed in an improved form across the country. Real-time flood inundation mapping covers now half of Texas, and the rest of our state is expected shortly. Publicly accessible flood map services from the National Weather Service depict current flood inundation and worst-case future flood inundation. Flood decision support gauges. Since 2017, with TxDOT support via research funding, we have initiated a consistent program that deploys novel radar stream gauges on TxDOT bridges. These gauges measure both water level and velocity rather than water level alone. TxDOT later expanded this program to 80 gauges, which are installed and operated by the U.S. Geological Survey. We call these flood decision support gauges because they measure stream flow during flood events. These gauges are particularly applicable because for flash flooding, because they can potentially detect the velocity spike that often precedes the rise in water level during rapidly rising flood flow. The nearest TxDOT flood decision support gauge is on the Guadalupe River at Comfort, just downstream of Kerrville. Provisional data provided by the USGS for the July 4th flood show that the water level began rising there at 8 a.m. The velocity spike happened at 8:10 a.m. and the water level peaked at 9:45 a.m., 1 hour and 35 minutes later. Now, I want to stop here. This is a really critical piece of data. What happened at 8:10 a.m. is that the velocity of water in the Guadalupe River increased from 2 feet per second to 14 feet per second in 5 minutes. It just went straight up. And then the water level, the water stage height gradually increased over the next 1.5 hours to 35 feet. But before that, there was a signal. So, Vice Chair Flores, you spoke about the monster. The monster was sending a signal. There was a signal coming ahead of that. And that's well understood in fluid mechanics. When you quickly increase the slope of the water, there's a velocity wave that gets sent out of the head of that, and that velocity wave is detectable. And our gauge at Comfort detected it in this July 4th flood. Now imagine if that gauge or gauge like that had been at the Mystic Camp. The flash flood occurs upstream, The velocity wave propagates downstream. The velocity spikes detected at the camp. The siren goes off. I mean, it doesn't take much to connect the dots here. So there are solutions that can emerge out of this. There is new kind of gauging that can occur. Although not suitable for all gauge sites, radar stream gauges have the potential to be less expensive than the full range gold standard USGS gauges, and they collect water level and velocity as compared to local flood alert gauges, which collect only water level. The TxDOT network is the largest deployment of radar stream gauges in the United States. While significant progress has been made, our work with TxDOT is still in the research phase and is not fully ready for operational use today. Integrating components into a seamless, unified system remains a challenge. To improve resiliency for future flood events, I recommend the following. Statewide flood decision support gauges. Texas has 25,000 bridges over water, more than any other state. We can use this as a foundation for a statewide coverage of flood decision support gauges by equipping more bridges with radar streamflow sensors. Texas Flood Hub. Data from all the real-time precipitation, streamflow, and water level gauge networks operating in Texas should be ingested into a single system that is publicly accessible. Improved flood inundation mapping. Over the past 5 years, Texas has developed base level engineering models for statewide flood planning. In parallel, we have developed the methods to translate the output of these models into real-time flood inundation maps. The application of these translation methods should be accelerated. Training center. A technological transformation in which real-time flood map services from the National Weather Services have become publicly accessible for everyone has occurred. The existence of these services is not well known and they are underutilized. A training center is needed for public officials and first responders to learn how to get direct access to flood map services during flood emergencies. Thank you for the opportunity to make this statement. I would be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, it's Dr. Medment, yes. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Are you familiar with the Bureau of Economic Geology?
Very familiar.
Okay. And you mentioned the advanced computation.
Yes.
Both in 2015 and 2015.
Yes.
Are you familiar with their work that they're doing in water mapping right now?
I'm sorry, the work they're doing?
The work that they're doing right now in water mapping.
Well, I do a lot of water mapping, so tell me about that.
Are you familiar with what they're doing
with right the TAC or the Bureau of Economic Geology?
I can't understand you, sir.
The Texas Advanced Computing Center or the Bureau of Economic Geology?
Together, both. Yes, sir.
No,
if you would mind, please, I would like you to take a look at get in touch with them at the Bureau of Economic Geology, and if you would look at what they're doing on water mapping, okay. I appreciate your feedback on it.
I'll do that.
That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Go course.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this esteemed panel. Very quickly, I believe it's Dr. Nielsen-Gammon. On page 5 of your testimony, I'm going to go to the second to the last paragraph. I'm not going to read it, but one of your testimony starting there talks about the. It's remarkable to me how poor the National Weather Service models were at providing 24-hour or 48 warnings of this event. Skip down to Del Rio, believe it or not, Del Rio is the only upper air station along the Texas border between El Paso and Brownsville, a distance of 706 miles. As the, I would say, crow flies, you chose Vulture. So herein lies the question. Who's in charge of these upper air stations, and why is there not one in between?
The National Weather Service is in charge of that.
Can you lean forward?
Oh, John Nielsen Gavin. The National Weather Service is in charge of the upper air stations. Presently, they are, after a reorganization of the Weather Service in the 90s, they were co-located with local offices of the National Weather Service. And those are the only two local offices. Well, the three listed are the only local offices along the border. So that's the reason there isn't anything in between.
Maybe we can remedy that. I'm going to go to now. I'm not sure who provided this. Was this?
That's the Speed Center.
If you would state your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Phil Bedian.
I'm noticing on your map, I think these are the forecast gauges with the red dot. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm going to let Dr. Fang answer that because he created that.
Okay, Dr. Fang, are those the present gauges or are those what y'all are proposing?
Those are existing gauges. And USGS and basically NOAA Weather Service, they provide those flood warnings, I mean, at those red dots as on these particular maps.
Obviously nothing along the South Fork where Camp Mystic is.
Currently, okay. But it's on the downstream of the confluence right there, that first one you see.
Okay, and then as I skip to Texas Tech, and your recommendations. So if I look at all of y'all's recommendations, and Dr. Maidment, your accent's a little different than mine, and this room's really hard to hear. And so if you could provide, if you don't mind, what you said in writing to us, that would be great to have as a reference. These recommendations, if we did this, Texas would pay for it. The National Weather Service and another station along 706 miles, could we coax them into doing that? And if we did the combination of these, would we have some pretty good, accurate forecasting? Somebody just say yes or no.
You're asking if
there's some recommendations.
All those things were.
Yeah. Here's some recommendations. I'm not a meteorologist. Maybe I desire to be one day. I like to read about weather. But we have the National Weather Service here and not having anything on a 706-mile distance. We have these recommendations from y'all.
Right.
Would the combination of those give us better forecasting?
On average, absolutely.
Okay. And so when we talk about costs and things like this, what are we talking about here on this Texas solution?
If all those recommendations were followed and it was scaled as it's shown in those images, you're talking about $20 million or so for that.
Okay. Did you give me a number there? Like
$20 million.
$20
million? Yes.
That is not very much money. And I what I would recommend to Chairman, if you're carrying this bill or whatever, sometimes we form committees and we take a long time. I don't care if we form a committee or not. But Texas is wealthy enough to spend $20 million to have better mapping. We can work with the National Weather Service to come up with another, I think, between 706 miles. We're a huge state. And the combination of that would give us better forecasting, which we talked about a great deal in the last hearing. Would y'all all agree? And we can do this and we can coordinate it. And then after we have that really good information, it's who gets and disseminates that information. Because what I have learned in looking at all these timelines, and I say this for all the parents who have lost children, at 1:14, the warning goes out. Really, they had minutes if you're on the South Fork, because the gentleman that testified here, who was a mile below Mystic, said he woke up at 2:40. I'm not going back in my notes, but 2:40 by 3:05, he said, we need to leave. And at that point, the water was around his house. He'd never seen that. And they've had that property since 1930s, I believe. And his estimation was at that point, it was 41 feet. Guys, the emergency warning didn't go out until after 4 a.m. We weren't even close for those along that portion of Guadalupe. So I think it's incumbent upon us to look at those timelines, to heed that, and to do better. And like, if flooding happens at 3 inches, which we heard in testimony in Austin, my goodness, how badly did we miss on this? It really is a life and death issue.
Yeah, one of the things that was mentioned multiple times up here was this reporting time interval and the fact that it needs to be, the reporting intervals need to be very quick on these measurements because the forecasters need the information in the heat of the moment. They need the information when minutes matter. We don't need to be waiting 30 minutes to get a report. We need it every 5 minutes or even less in cases.
Agree. And if you travel out to hunt, you realize that this is a two-lane highway, a very narrow highway. There was no way you could evacuate unless you had started at earlier on July 3rd, way earlier when you're talking about a holiday weekend. So it really was the warning to seek higher ground and seek it now. Do y'all agree?
Yes.
Yes.
Lessons learned. We need to put it into action. Doctor, do you have something to say?
Yes, John Nielsen Gammon. I want to mention the observational recommendations are talking less than $1 million, and the federal government would pay for part of them through the National Mesonet Program, which already has helped support the Mesonets that we have heard about already.
Bingo. Thank you.
Sid Martinez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And first of all, Dr. Guthrie, thank you. Thank you very much, because this has absolutely answered some questions I had last week. And when I was asking about getting historical data, this actually answered a lot of the questions. I was told that that was forecasting, and it's not. Because when you accumulate historical data over the years, would this be able, by what you're showing us here today, would that be able to tell locals when they're working on a flood mitigation plan on what the impacts are in those certain areas by the amount of rainfall that has been accumulated on that data?
The information would be useful for that purpose.
So it would be available and they could do that. And then another thing that I was looking at, and I kept on kind of trying to find answers for this, and I got on the website, the Interagency Flood Risk Management website, which is actually very helpful. And I looked up Kerrville and I looked up the Rio Grande Valley. And if there were gauges and additional gauges, because this also shows us forecasting on it as well. And for example, right here, it says streams rising and falling. This is available to the public as well, right? So if they have any type of, if they want to have some warning devices, would this be able to be utilized? Because here it says water level rising, above a foot of an hour, water level rising above 2 feet an hour. So it's kind of giving you that, and then it's showing you in different areas where the low water crossings are, where not to go. I mean, it's giving you a lot of data. And is this data on that flood decision support toolbox, is this in real time?
I am not familiar with the flood decision support toolbox.
Okay. Well, it shows Water Development Board on it.
I'm sorry, that's our flood division, so I'm just not.
Yeah,
I'm
so, but this is, right, go ahead.
I just said I'm in the surface water division, so we don't, the only way we touch flood is with the Tex-Mesonet network and our USGS flood gauges.
Okay, so I'm assuming that this is also kind of linked to maybe the National Weather Service and obtaining the data from gauges that through the flows of rivers and creeks and on lakes. And that's what I'm assuming that's, it's picking up here. And then I go over and I look at the Tex-Mesonet, and that's also giving us some forecasting data on rainfall and the amount of rain that's falling. Am I correct? And
correct. It's showing observed rainfall data that's being collected by rain gauges, but there's also some information about forecast warnings and other information on the website as well.
Okay, wonderful. So if we're gathering all this data and we want to say in 2018, let's say one of the cities wants to find out what the impacts are so that that way they could have a flood mitigation plan. And they want to figure that out and say, okay, listen, I need to figure out how much rain fell in these areas during this rainstorm and the ones that were impacted the most and by the rise and fall of the water. And how should I invest my money for flood mitigation? You all would have that data compiled so that they could be able to do that. Is that correct?
The data would be available at Synoptic, and there'd be other sources probably available for that consultant or researcher to use to do that work.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, there's a lot of knowledge sitting there, seven people. With all your knowledge, with the models, are they just theoretical? Have they been measured? Did you use any of the knowledge you have or the models that you've talked about or patterns that you've talked about on this storm that we just had? Or is it just something you've got to pay for and have put in place? Any of you? Not a long answer, just a...
Let me try to answer that. So the floodplain map library approach that we've been talking about in Houston, we think directly applicable here in the Guadalupe Valley. What it does is it takes measured 15-minute radar data across the whole watershed.
Did y'all
area.
Do that this time?
Say it again.
Did y'all use it this
time? Yeah, it comes from the National Weather Service, and it gets ground truth, and it's used. We use it in Houston.
What did you do with the information? Would it have helped? Did you share it with anybody?
We didn't have it.
You didn't have it.
At the time of the flood. We just ran this just recently.
After. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
It wasn't operational at the time. You ran it, and it's in the handouts. You'll see the amounts there. It's very, very detailed, and it's very, very centered in the far upper end where you see 6 inches of rain in about 3 hours.
Thank you for that.
Sure.
Of course, we'd want things to give us advanced warning, not backup. And I suppose the model, if I really looked at it, would do that.
Yes, the idea is that rain would then convert to those floodplain maps, and it would provide that information downstream. Yes.
Dynamically, just as it's happening.
Yes, as a function of time.
You.
Yes.
Thank you. And then to any of you, or maybe John, with TDEM, was there any cloud seeding going on? That may sound kind of far out there, but was there any cloud seeding any days before this flood?
I don't have any knowledge of the cloud seeding. I know that cloud seeding does go on. Even if it were, that would not have really significantly contributed to the flooding.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir.
John Nielsen-Gammon. There was cloud seeding on July 2nd in Karnes County. I understand it. I ran a trajectory model.
Can you just speak maybe a little slower and louder in the mic?
There was cloud seeding in Karnes County in July 2nd. I ran a trajectory model, and the air that was seeded would have ended up in Nebraska or South Dakota by the time of the flood.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Burdell.
Thank you, Chairman King. Just a couple quick questions again. Y'all are mentioning like the modeling maps. Are y'all familiar with the North Carolina flood inundation map? Have y'all seen that one?
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Okay. And do we have anything like that in Texas that an emergency manager or anybody can go to right now to basically see, for those who aren't familiar with the map, you can go to it, you can put in how much rain you expect or the height of the water, and it will map out where the flooding is. It lets emergency management know what roads to shut down, what buildings are touched. It'll actually even calculate the amount of damage that the buildings in the area will receive from that. Do we have anything like that in Texas?
Yes, the Flood Decision Support Toolbox that we've been discussing is a similar system.
Okay, what's that name again?
The Flood Decision Support Toolbox.
Flood Decision.
That's a similar system to the North Carolina.
Okay, and do we have access to that now?
Yes, we do.
Okay, copy that. Thank you. And then next question, which is just kind of a Forrest Gump question. So sometimes technology can be, I made sure I wrote this down so I didn't mess it up. Sometimes too much technology can become a hindrance and we begin to rely less on common sense. I know you mentioned that it's hard to take out the human factor that happens. If we look back at data over 20 or 40 years, and we spent billions of dollars on this technology. Y'all have dedicated your lives to saving people, which we greatly appreciate. Would you say that we're safer today than even 20 or 40 years ago related to flash floods or anything like that?
I think we are safer, but we are getting bigger floods.
Yeah.
There's no question about that, but I think we're definitely safer. There's so much information out there. There's so much gauging, and there are these model development tools available on the iPhone for warning. So it's gotten better. It's just we've got to work on that communication link. That is the missing link right now. We've got to make sure that there are folks on the ground, boots on the ground, emergency managers, mayors, folks in charge that get that information in a useful way.
I appreciate you bringing that point up. I think that's the most important point.
It's the most important.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So I served during Hurricane Harvey in the state operations center. For the first 2 days of Harvey, we really didn't know much about what was going on at all. So we had resources coming in from all over the country, and they were asking, how do I deploy? Now, do I deploy from Sealy? Do I deploy from Conroe? Do I fly in from San Antonio? We couldn't really respond. As time went on, the number of maps that were produced increased until there was a deluge. We were completely overwhelmed. What we needed at the time was one water map across the whole state. What's going on now? What's going on 7 o'clock tonight? What's going on 7 o'clock tomorrow morning? That did not exist in 2014, but it is about to exist now. Now, that's a critical step forward. Right? What that means is that the response community, Chief Tidd and Tidd and Zone, can see this water situation at the State Operations Center as the people are seeing it on the ground where they are. Now, that is a huge step forward.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Thank you all for your time, too. Appreciate it.
Senator Schwartner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is to Dr. Bedient, Dr. Fang. I'm referencing this, your handout from Rice Engineering Computing. Just to make it perfectly clear, on the back page, Dr. Torres, who's not part of the panel, but he's gauge design and placement. What I care about most is the last line of defense before something tragic occurs at headwaters, which appears to be what happened here, without the ability to contact the county judge and get him up and get him to, order a higher ground, for instance. It has to be automatic, it seems like, at headwaters of various rivers. Does the technology exist to measure the rise in a river, either through ultrasound, radar, a simple buoy gauge, and have it remotely go to a siren that's battery powered, yes, that goes off,
yes,
when a certain level of river rise occurs within a certain amount of time? Can y'all please just say yes or no to that?
Yes, that technology exists. You can turn lights on. You could set it up for the alarm to go off.
And how much is a... It depends on how many gauges and sirens and things, but I mean, in general, what is kind of it seems like a fairly basic kind of last minute line of defense. Something serious is about to occur. What does that cost? Is it installed across the state anywhere?
One of our strong recommendations was to add about 20 or 25 gauges into the Guadalupe Basin, and these can be put in easily in the range of $10,000 to $20,000. Remember, you've got to build these if you're putting them against low water crossings or against bridges. You've got to build them so they withstand the onslaught of about a 30-foot wave.
Right? And again, are they installed in any river basin at the headwaters in the state that you're aware of, that we could look at, or people that we're going to hire look at as a state and go?
Oh, yeah, they're
all over?
There are basins that have them all throughout the basin, yeah.
And Dr. Torres does this type of work, who's not here, and he's the guy that he designs them, I guess, gauges. So
he's in the audience.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for your engineering.
Yes. Thank you for your question.
Sir, if the network of 80 radar gauges that I was talking about were extended to 800, I believe that would provide a base level of coverage across the state and a densified coverage in the Hill Country. The capital cost of that would be about $7 million, and there would be ongoing O&M costs.
Representative Moody.
Thank you very much. I have a couple questions for Dr. Nielsen-Gammon. And I appreciate everybody's testimony. I think it's very helpful. I mean, I think drilling down into the testimony you've offered is going to help create guideposts for us going forward. As we've had the hearings and taken up witnesses, I've heard over and over again, multiple times, we've never seen anything like this. We've never seen anything like this. And I think we're conflating that into the level of maybe the level of destruction and loss of life in this incident. And I was looking through page 3 and 4 of the written testimony you provided us, where you've listed out events in this area that, in your words, rivaled or exceeded what happened on the 4th. So I just want to kind of crystallize that, because the conditions that can create this type of destruction have been seen. And in fact, your bolded statement at the end of this paragraph is, based on you counting these events, we can expect a 35-inch rainstorm somewhere in the area, an average of every 2 decades. Can you help me dig into how, you know, these instances, where they occurred, population? I mean, do you have that kind of data too? Because I think we're conflating the level of loss of life and the conditions that could exist. So are these examples you've listed here, are these conditions that, if in a populated area like this, could create the same or similar effect, loss of life and destruction of property?
Yes, John Nielsen Gammon, thank you for your question. It depends upon a variety of circumstances. So, for example, in the 1932 flood, cabins that housed campers in the South Fork were destroyed. But there was no loss of life, and the camp managers reported that was because the flood happened during the daytime, and they could see what was going on, and they could evacuate safely. So this flood was particularly damaging in terms of loss of life because of the time it occurred and the difficulty for people to understand what was going on. Similar rainfall tolls were happening anywhere, and you know, we have to be the next flood's not going to be, hopefully, in this river valley, is going to be another one nearby somewhere, and we have to be prepared for all of those. Part of the problem is people not having seen something like this before. I've seen some interesting technology looking at storm surges, where you basically can do a three-dimensional picture of, like, Google Maps of the terrain and show how high a flood would be and what it would actually look like. And that has a bigger impact than a flood map does on people's perception of what's possible.
No, and I think that's what's important, because I think when we talk about we never see anything like this, right, there was a number of, and I think we had some reports in our first hearing, there were a number of factors that were very unique to this that really exacerbated the damage, the destruction, the devastation. But I think what your data tells us here is, you know, we've been speaking in terms of 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years. These are conditions that exist more frequently than that, and just maybe don't have those other factors. And that's just a matter of, I mean, I'm not gonna say chance, but I mean, it is a matter of those things not kind of coming together at the same time. And so when we're looking at this, I think that's what the urgency is. And I hope that people drill down into the data that you provided. And I think this data, if we use this data, and from all of you actually, right, we have amazing tools available to us. The pivot forward from there, and I know we have someone from the Water Development Board, and kind of mirroring off what Vice Chair Martinez talked about, the game plan going forward, right? That data informs where the risk is. I mean, I'm looking at the 300-page report from 2023 on the flood plan for this region. You know, that's got a number of deficiencies. It's got a number of ideas. It's got a number of concepts. And I think what we need to do is figure out how the data informs that better. And then as policymakers and as those who look at budgets, right, Water Development Board exists to identify those things. We also task them with opportunities to fund those and figuring out how to triage that, because these are events that are going to happen in our mind. We can't push that out to 100, 500 years. I mean, those are metrics we use for convenience of understanding these events. But this is going to happen, and triaging this into the highest risk areas, because those are all laid out. We have it. We've We have it all. And this event is going to help better inform those things. And so I, not a question, but as we work forward, you know, this is a group of folks that we need to figure out how to harness that and put that into action in communities like that. And it is, it becomes a funding question at some point, and how we prioritize things. And that's where really the complex part of our job is going to come into play. What do we put into statute that says, here's how we want this to unfold? Because 20, 30 years down the road, we do not want this type of tragic event to this level of devastation when we had a plan on paper and we just didn't fund it. And so I want to thank you all for the work you do. And I want to thank the prescient Governor Briscoe for creating state climatologists here in Texas, because it is an office that we should utilize more in the work that we do going forward, because this is not going to slow down. Thank you.
Senator Menendez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the whole panel, thank you. Dr. Bedian and Dr. Fang, your partner is Dr. Torres.
Yes.
I wish he would be on the panel with you, but maybe you can help answer for him. He's the expert, and we've established he's installed over 60 flood gauges in the state of Texas, correct? So
yes.
These are remote. These tell, they can tell the flow, early flood warning systems, automatic activation. Is there the technology? Is it available? Because I've heard from people, well, the sirens may not work because we can't hear them inside. Here's the thing. What do most people already have inside their homes to detect something while they're sleeping? Can you answer that question? If you have a fire in your home, do most people not have a smoke detector? Is there the technology available that in the event of a flood, that if you had homes in a floodplain, that this technology could say, so the alarm could go off and you could say, start, go to higher ground now. Is that technology available?
Senator, let me give a first step right here. I would say yes. First thing, cell phone service is right there. I mean, it actually can be easily tapping into this decision. And for the people sign up, I mean, they will be able to receive those warning timely.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm thinking about the camps of these children. They didn't have their cell phones with them. They didn't let the children have them in there. So if they'd had something in these bunks and say, and the alarm starts going off, the counselors get up and say, move to higher ground now, and the alarm's going off. You can't ignore that.
I would say, I mean, such a device to trigger off the warning, it's a very feasible. I mean, it's right there too. And based on what I talked to Dr. Torres, and he mentioned about the data feed and the signal being sent is transmitted, could also go on the satellite. So right. That will be, I will be the second channel to make the communication smooth.
Well, I mean, and this is not something you need in every home in America. You just need it in the ones that are in these flood alleys.
I totally agree with you.